I want you to meet Brian Sweeney. Brian, as you might be able to tell somewhat from these pictures, flew for the Navy. Now, Brian wasn't just a normal naval pilot, although if that could be a thing, you might say, he was an exceptional Navy pilot. It brings up special sort of relevance today when we think of one of the number one leading movies in the past quarter has been the second Top Gun movie. This man was really Top Gun. And not just did he attend the Top Gun school, he was a Top Gun flight instructor in the 90s. So he would have been one of the teachers to teach Maverick and Goose all the things they learned, right? He was a big man. He probably was larger than what most naval pilots would have been. But in 1997, his career had to come to a surprising end because of some accident that he was in. He had to be medically discharged. But that didn't stop Brian. Not even a year later, he met Julia. In fact, Julia says that when she saw Brian for the first time in the bar where they met, she turned to a friend and said, "That's the kind of man I would like to marry." It wasn't very long before they were dating, and 7 months later, they got married. And they moved to Cape Cod, Massachusetts, a place that Brian said he always loved and enjoyed. Now, Brian's life didn't stop when he got out of the Navy. He actually thrived outside the Navy. He became a government defense contractor, which is code word that we like to say, do the same thing you did in the military, but get paid better for it. And while he wasn't flying F-14s anymore, Brian had a really sweet setup. You see, in the early days of working from home, this is the late 90s, early 2000s, he would work from home, and it was said that he could actually work at the beach sometimes. He would tease Julie and say, "I can work at the beach." And then he would fly to Los Angeles once a month for a week to touch base with his contract company. Julia, she also was doing well. She had become a teacher, and she was really enjoying her career. But one morning, this all changed. You see, Brian was getting on an airplane to go to Los Angeles for his monthly meeting, and Julia went to school to teach, a day like any other day. School was pretty fresh in session, so I'm sure Julia was very busy trying to get to know the names of the kids and all the things that are going on in the classroom. And somehow she gets a phone call, maybe on one of her breaks, from her mother-in-law. She says, "Julia, you need to go home. You need to pick up the phone." That's not a message you want to hear. When she gets home, Julia has a voicemail from Brian. "Jules, this is Brian. Listen, I'm on an airplane that's been hijacked. If things don't go well, and it's not looking good, I just want you to know I absolutely love you. I want you to do good. Go have good times. Same to my parents and everybody. I just totally love you, and I'll see you when you get there." 9 minutes later, his plane crashes into the South Tower of the World Trade Center. He and an untold number of people died instantly in a crash that was never supposed to happen. Life was normal. He had a hotel planned in Los Angeles. He had a meeting tomorrow. He had a tomorrow. We have a tomorrow on mind, don't we? We have planners that have appointments for Monday, for Tuesday. I've got a little trip to Cheyenne. I'm planning Tuesday and Wednesday. Some of us are traveling out of town. Some of us are going to work. Some of us are calling friends and family. We have a tomorrow planned, don't we? Something that's been made very vibrantly vivid in my mind in recent months is sometimes there is no tomorrow. In fact, I should probably say it this way. For each one of us, there will be someday no longer any more tomorrows. Some people have a pretty good idea about the time frame that might happen, but many don't. I've been in people's homes here in Estes Park that they had plans for tomorrow, but today was the last one they had. I look at some of these people and I say, they had plans for tomorrow. You look around, you see they had plans for tomorrow. Brian had plans for tomorrow. Julia had plans for Brian the week he got back. How is it that we are getting ready today for what we think is going to happen tomorrow? The Bible reminds us that we are vapors. It's an illustration you might be able to relate to when you have this pot that you're boiling water and there's vapor that's coming up off the water. All you have to do is turn on that little fan above your oven and it just gets sucked right away. It's gone. Now, before exhaust fans, you can just blow on it and it goes away. But people understand that a vapor it's insubstantial. It's insignificant. It's not going to stop anything, is it? It's not really going to make a big impact. It's temporary. And the Bible tells us that our lives are like vapor. We're temporary. In fact, that word that the NIV translates as meaningless, the NAS translates as vanity, but it really means we are but vapors, like smoke. In James chapter 4, we're reminded of this truth beginning in verse 13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to the one who does the right or knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. James is dealing with the idea of arrogant plans. He's not saying it's wrong to plan. He's not saying you shouldn't have anything on your calendar tomorrow and just live your life willy-nilly. What he's saying is arrogant plans, confidence, knowing that I'm going to make these things happen. I know what's going to happen tomorrow. This is an idea that God is very strongly opposed to. And we see that when Jesus talks about the parable of the rich man who builds bigger barns. And he says, I'm going to take my ease now. And God says, you fool, tonight I require your soul. The Ecclesiastes author tells us that all the pursuits in the world don't really add up to anything meaningful. The only way we find meaning is if we serve the Lord. I think James is down the same vein of thinking. He says we should not be arrogant about our plans. In verse 13, he says, we have all these goals in mind. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we're going to go to such and such a city and spend a year and engage in business and make a profit. Now, the context of James seems to be that there are Christians, believers, that are struggling with wealth. And I'm not saying they're poor. I'm saying they're very wealthy, and they're handling it inappropriately. And specifically, the context of chapter 4 seems to suggest that there's a lot of divisions and selfishness going on in the congregations that James is writing to. He says one of the solutions that needs to happen is that these rich, wealthy people need to be less arrogant about their plans. See, we can kind of relate to this because we would be considered pretty wealthy compared to what maybe the earliest recipients of this letter would be. We plan business, right? We plan for how our actual business is going to go, or maybe how our work is going to go, how we're going to do with this investment or that investment. We plan on where we're going to be, where we're going to move, what's going to happen to our house, when we're going to sell this, when we're going to do that thing. We've got all these plans in mind. And James says it could be arrogant if we say, these are the things I'm going to do and I know it. I know it. This is what's going to happen. The problem, he says in verse 14, is you don't actually even know what tomorrow is going to bring. You do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're just a vapor. You appear for a little while, and then you vanish away. I could be driving home tonight from evening service, hit an elk, and die. I'm probably one of the last people we would expect to just suddenly die, unless you know my driving habits, right? No, you'd be shocked, right? Or what if I keeled over from a heart attack? Gabe, he's not even quite 36 yet. He has a heart attack and dies. I wouldn't be the first. I wouldn't be the first, right? And this is what James is telling us. He says, you can't know what tomorrow is going to bring. Don't be arrogant like you're the one in control of what tomorrow looks like. Now, all of us have experiences in our life where we had plans and they didn't really unfold the way we thought they would, right? I see some of you have very specific things popped in your mind, right? And so James says the solution to this arrogance is actually humility. Verses 15 and 16, he says, instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. We must submit our plans to God. Now, unfortunately, as is the way of religious people, we take this verse to be a mantra or a formula, we say. Hey, am I going to see you on Tuesday? Well, if the Lord wills, took care of my bases. I'm not violating James chapter 4, right? Because I said, if the Lord wills. That's not what James is saying here. James is saying, we don't know what God has in store. What if a meteorite hits that town? You're not going to that town to make business anymore, right? What if a meteorite hits your car on the way to that town? You're not going to that town anymore. He says, God is in control. That's the point here, right? We need to recognize God is in control. You know, if God is okay with it, I'm going to keep working here in Estes Park as a preacher. If God is okay with it, I'm going to keep going to my army drills. If God is okay with it, I'm going to keep with my family, my two kids. I don't know what tomorrow brings. God does. And so I'm going to have the humility to submit my plans to God. And James has a strong rebuke here in verse 16. He says to boast about what you're going to do. Or this idea of boasting is, I'm the one in charge. See, boasting is something that you can brag about under your own power, right? I did this myself. It says boasting is a sin. The sense of boasting in this context is, I have tomorrow under control. It's part of the problem with one of Gabe's personality traits I talk about. You guys know that I'm prone to be a prepper at heart. I have the food hidden away in some closet. I have the extra ammunition. I don't actually have extra ammunition. I can't afford ammo. But I've got extra food. I've got it under control when those zombies come over the hill. And he says, that's arrogant reliance on self. Now, we may not be planning for the zombie apocalypse. We may be planning for how I'm going to retire at this level of comfort. And he may say, God may say, you know what? Guess what's going to happen when China goes to war with the U.S.? You're going to be drafted. The economy is going to tank. You're going to move. And a flood's going to wipe out your house. Like, we don't know what tomorrow brings. And so, and we can't control it either. This last Tuesday, I had to take a class called Emergency Vehicle Operators Course. It's the 4-hour course you have to take before you're allowed to put lights on your car and drive really super fast. You're not allowed to drive really super fast, is what I learned in the class. But one of the things that really stuck out to me is the instructor started off by saying, you need to recognize you are in control of nothing. You can control a little bit in your car, but you can't control whether that other driver sees you. You can't control if that other driver here can hear you. You can't control if you can't hear another vehicle with sirens because yours are too loud. You need to recognize you are not really in control. And I thought, that's what James is saying. Recognize we are not the ones in control. God is the one in control. Which means there should be a certain response, a certain focus that should be in our lives when we recognize that God is the one in control. Therefore, James writes, recognizing we're not in control, therefore, to the one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is a sin. This is the application portion of leaning on God, submitting our plans to God. And the first thing he says, you need to know what the right thing is. You can't actually obey this portion of James's letter if you don't understand God's will. So there's a little bit of homework before we apply this. But this letter isn't to baby Christians in the faith. It is to some Christians that are struggling with their maturity in their faith at times. But he expects these people to know the right thing, to understand the right thing. And so this is why it's so relevant to you and I. This is not a passage I'm sure is new to anyone in this room. This is a passage that's a reminder that you know better, right? You know better is kind of what James is saying here. So if you know better and then you ignore it, you don't do the thing that you should be doing, that's a sin. In this context, he's saying, you know better not to rely on yourself, on your own strength, on your own power, might, and prowess. You know that's not the right decision. You know that if you're going to make plans, they need to be in line with God's will, to recognize that God may change those plans. And okay, God may change them. So you need to do the right thing. Do the right thing in preparation for those plans. Do the right thing if the plans change. At the beginning of 2020, we had certain plans in mind. But circumstances changed those plans, didn't they? And then we had some options. We can act like the world or we can act like Christians. And honestly, that was a hard one for us. In different ways, right? For some of us, it might have been a struggle how we treated other people who disagreed with us. For some of us, it may have been a struggle for what's going to happen tomorrow, like the fear that might come from either a sickness or my business or whatever the case might be, right? October 21st, 2020, we had plans for October 22nd. I don't see a person in this room who didn't leave town on October 22nd when the fires came a-knocking. Where were you when the floods came in 2013? Were you when Hurricane Katrina hit, right? Like all these things, you don't know what's going to happen. So we need to plan accordingly. We need to live our lives doing the right thing, no matter what. You get a cancer diagnosis. You find out a family member's died. You find out your business is failing. Know the right thing and do the right thing. So we're not promised tomorrow. None of us is entitled to tomorrow, and that includes right now. You're not entitled to November 14th. Now, all the evidence points to that you're going to wake up on November 14th. You get to try to execute whatever plans you have, but James is reminding us that November 14th isn't a promise. And so you need to submit any plans you have for tomorrow to the Lord. Is it in line with his will? Is it recognizing that only God has the power to make those things a reality? You realize that the sun doesn't just continue existing on its own. Contrary to what astronomers tell us, God wills that the stars keep working. God wills that your heart keeps working. God wills that your brain is still working the way it's supposed to. We need a plan today to submit our efforts and our focus on God. And if we've made mistakes in the past, we've kind of messed that up and said, okay, I've been trying to do it all in my own power. We repent of that. Say, okay, God, I'm sorry. I want to go ahead and make sure that today I'm starting to rely on you, to recognize that these plans are in line or should be in line with your will. And so we live obedient lives. But I also want to submit to you that we should live meaningful lives. If you don't have tomorrow, and we've all played this game in our minds before, and it's a nice thought until it becomes a reality, right? What if you're told you only have 6 months left to live? What do you do with those 6 months? Are you not worried about where the stock market's going? You're not worried about what people think of your wheels on your car? You're not worried about whether or not your house is going to, if that plumbing leak is going to be fixed in 20 years or if it's going to continue to be a problem? You're not worried about those things because you've got a very short time focus. So you're going to do meaningful things. You're going to spend meaningful time with people that are important to you. One of the more impressive things I remember hearing about Glenda when she was in her final weeks, she had that conversation with one of her friends. That's a conversation we always think, well, I can do that tomorrow. It's a conversation you're afraid to have because you don't want to hurt their feelings. You don't want to maybe lose that friend. And if I remember the details as they were told to me correctly, Glenda told one of her friends, I just want to tell you how important Jesus has been to my life and that I have hope for what happens after I die because of him, and I want you to have that same hope. I just want to be very clear that you need Jesus. Are you being meaningful with your time? Not just saying, oh, I trust God for my finances, oh, I trust God for my health, but rather, I'm helping others find the same hope in God that I have. Let's be reflective this week as we think about our lives and how we're living them. Realize that, yeah, we don't have tomorrow guaranteed, so how can I be more meaningful and obedient in my life today? Let's all stand together.